emphysema, says his son, who also reports that by the time of his father's death, Dr. Kurt Bloma was alone and estranged from the world. Albert Speer served all 20 years of his sentence at Spandau Prison outside Berlin, despite the efforts by John J. McCloy as U.S. High Commissioner for Germany to get Speer released earlier. In 1956, McCloy wrote to Speer's wife, Margareta, "I have a very strong conviction that your husband should be released and would be very happy if I could do anything to expedite such a release." In prison, Speer secretly worked on the memoirs he would publish upon his release. On pieces of toilet paper, cigarette wrappers, and paper scraps, he jotted down recollections of his days working alongside Hitler and the Inner Circle. It was illegal to write and send unscreened notes out of Spandau, so Speer had his writing smuggled out by two sympathetic Dutch Red Cross nurses. The notes were delivered to Speer's old friend and colleague, Rudolf Walters, a die-hard Hitler loyalist living in Berlin. Over the course of 20 years, Walters painstakingly typed up tens of thousands of these individual paper scraps that Speer continued to send to him. After 20 years, they amounted to a 1,000-page manuscript, which Walters turned over to Speer upon Speer's release. With the advance payments Speer received on his memoirs, he would write two, Inside the Third Reich and Spandau, The Secret Diaries. Speer became a wealthy man once again. He earned a reported 680,000 Deutschmarks from Die Welt for serialization rights, and a reported $350,000 advance, roughly $2.4 million in 2013, for English-language book rights. Albert Speer bought a sports car and embarked on a new life as a successful author. He never thanked or acknowledged Rudolf Walters for his 20 years of work, at least not in his book and not publicly. A decade later, Speer defended this decision to his biographer, Gita Zereni, saying, "It was for Walter's own protection." Walter's son reported that when Walter's died, the last word he uttered was Speer. After Speer sent Wernher von Braun a copy of Spandau, von Braun wrote a letter to his old friend and former boss at the Reich's Ministry of Armaments and War Production, pointing out how divergent their lives had been over the past 20 years. While Speer had been at Spandau Prison, von Braun's star had risen steadily. He thanked Speer for the book. "How often I thought of you during those last 20 long years when so much was happening in my life," wrote von Braun. When Siegfried Knaemeyer learned that Albert Speer was out of prison, Knaemeyer took a trip to visit his old friend in Germany. The last time the two men had seen each other was in Berlin in April 1945, when Knaemeyer was helping Speer plot his escape to Greenland. In the years that Speer had been in prison, Knaemeyer had been working for the United States, formerly the sworn enemy of both men. As an employee of the U.S. Air Force in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, Knaemeyer worked on classified and unclassified projects, won awards, and rose up through the ranks. For the Air Force, he established the Pilot Factors Program, which coordinated technologies as aircraft went from subsonic to supersonic flight. Upon his retirement in 1977, Pentagon officials awarded Knaemeyer their highest civilian award, the Distinguished Civilian Service Award. Knaemeyer died of emphysema 2 years later, on April 11, 1979. His last wish was that his body be immediately taken to a crematory and that no funeral be held. He served his native country, Germany, and his adopted country, America, with equal enthusiasm and dedication, said his son, Sigurd Knaemeyer. To the end, Albert Speer denied that he had direct knowledge of the Holocaust. 67 years after interviewing Speer at the Ashcan interrogation facility in Luxembourg, John Dollebois still takes umbrage at this. I asked Speer if he was at the Wannsee conference at which Himmler announced the final solution for eradicating Jews, Dollebois explains. In my opinion, anyone who was at that meeting could not say he knew nothing about extermination camps like Auschwitz, Sobibor, Birkenau. Speer first denied being at Wannsee, then admitted to me he was there, but left before lunch and missed the important announcements. Others also asserted Speer was not telling the truth. I think he should have been hanged. Albert Speer died in a London hotel room in 1981. He was in town doing an interview for the BBC. One seldom recognizes when the devil puts his hand on your shoulder, Albert Speer told James P. O'Donnell in a New York Times Magazine interview shortly after his release from Spandau. He was referring to Hitler, but might have been talking about himself. Chapter 23. What Lasts. In the 1970s, several events led to a major shift in the American public's perception of the Holocaust, Nazis, and the United States. A series of congressional oversight hearings were convened as a result of many high-profile cases of Nazi war criminals found living in America. The hearings drew attention to the fact that the Immigration and Naturalization Service had been negligent in its investigations of these individuals, and in turn led to the creation of the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations. Then came the 1978 broadcast of NBC's four-part miniseries, Holocaust, which broke records for family viewing and made Americans who had never contemplated the Holocaust think seriously about what had happened in Nazi Germany and what the state-sponsored murder of 6 million people really meant. These events set the stage for a simple, fortuitous occurrence for a young Harvard law student named Eli Rosenbaum, the consequences of which would profoundly impact the paperclip scientist who had something to hide. In 1980, Eli Rosenbaum was perusing book titles inside a Cambridge bookstore when he came across Dora, the Nazi concentration camp where modern space technology was born and 30,000 prisoners died, written by a former Dora prisoner, the French resistance fighter Jean Michel. The narrative is detailed and revelatory in its brutal honesty. Jean Michel called his book an homage to the 30,000 slave laborers who died building the V-2s. He comments on the memoirs written by Wernher von Braun and General Dornberger, and the countless interviews given by many of the other V-2 scientists who worked under Project Paperclip. None of these Germans, notes Michel, utters a word about Nordhausen. I do not reproach these men with not having made public confessions after the war, Michel writes. I do not hold it against the scientists that they did not choose to be martyrs when they discovered the truth about the death camps. No, mine is a more modest objective. I make my stand solely against the monstrous distortion of history, which, in silencing certain facts and glorifying others, has given birth to false, foul, and suspect myths. In that same Cambridge bookstore on that same day, Eli Rosenbaum came across a second book about the V-2 rocket. This one was called The Rocket Team, and was written by Frederick I. Ordway III and Mitchell R. Sharp, with an introduction by Wernher von Braun. The book discusses and quotes the German scientists involved in the U.S. rocket program. In one part of the book, engineer Arthur Rudolph, praised as the developer of NASA's Saturn V rocket program, shares his thoughts with the authors. Rudolph is not identified as having once been operations director at the Middlework slave labor facility. Rudolph relates an anecdote from the war concerning his dismay at being called away from a New Year's Eve party in 1943-44 because of a problem with some of the V-2 rockets. An accompanying photograph shows a POW in striped prisoner pajamas moving rocket parts. Eli Rosenbaum had spent the previous summer working for the Department of Justice in its Office of Special Investigations. He knew that the Geneva Convention forbade nations from forcing prisoners of war to work on munitions. He had also just read about what went on in the Nordhausen tunnels in Jean-Michel's book, Dora. Rosenbaum later recalled that he was particularly offended by Rudolph's taking umbrage at missing a gala party while slave laborers toiled. The following year, after graduating from Harvard Law School, Rosenbaum started full-time work at the Department of Justice as a trial lawyer. He persuaded his boss, Neil M. Scherr, to open an investigation into Arthur Rudolph. In September of 1982, Marianne Rudolph, the daughter of Arthur Rudolph, received an unexpected telephone call at her home in San Jose, California. It was the Department of Justice calling. They explained that they had been trying to reach her father, Arthur Rudolph, who apparently lived nearby, but that they had been unable to do so. Marianne Rudolph, who worked as an artist for NASA, told the caller that her parents were vacationing in Germany and would be back at the end of the month. The day after the Rudolphs returned, Arthur Rudolph received a registered letter in the mail from the Department of Justice, Office of Special Investigations. The letter stated that questions had been raised regarding Arthur Rudolph's activities during the Second World War. Rudolph was asked to meet with DOJ officials at the San Jose Hyatt on October 13th, and to bring any documents with him that he owned covering the period between 1933 and 1945. During this first meeting, which included Arthur Rudolph, OSI Director Alan A. Ryan Jr., Deputy Director Neil M. Scherr, and trial attorney Eli Rosenbaum, the interview lasted 5 hours. There were two central questions the lawyers wanted answered. Owing to what set of principles had Rudolph decided to join the Nazi Party, which he did in 1933, and what exactly did he know about the Nordhausen executions, specifically about the prisoners who had been hanged from a crane? DOJ lawyers Allen, Scherr, and Rosenbaum had documents with them, including the previously sealed testimony from the 1947 Dora Nordhausen trial. These documents included pre-trial investigative material regarding former paperclip specialist George Rickey. Among the documents was the interview that Rudolph gave on June 2, 1947, to Major Eugene Smith of the U.S. Army Air Force. In that testimony, Rudolph had first said that he never saw any prisoners beaten or hanged. Later in the interview with Major Smith, Rudolph changed his story to say that he had been forced to watch the hangings but had nothing to do with them. During the San Jose Hyatt interview in 1982, the three Justice Department lawyers presented Rudolph with the drawing made by his former Nordhausen colleagues from Fort Bliss, the rocket engineers Gunther Haukohl, Rudolf Schlitt, Hans Pallero, and Eric Ball. This drawing illustrated the layout inside the tunnels and had been used as evidence in the Dora Nordhausen trial. The Justice Department lawyers pointed out to Rudolph that there was a clear dotted line labeled Path of Overhead Crane Trolley on which men were hung. The dotted line ran right by Rudolph's office, which suggested that it would have been impossible for Rudolph not to have seen the hangings. The lawyers asked why he had lied. They also asked Rudolph about his testimony from the 1947 Dora Nordhausen trial that revealed that at the Middlework Tunnel Complex, he received daily prisoner strength reports which showed the number of prisoners available for work, the number of new arrivals, and the number of people lost through sickness or death. They said that clearly Rudolph knew people were being worked to death and were being replaced by fresh bodies from the Dora Nordhausen concentration camp. Back in Washington, D.C., the Justice Department put together its case. 4 months later, on February 4, 1983, a second meeting took place at the San Jose Hyatt, and shortly thereafter, Rudolph received a letter from the Justice Department in the mail. "Certain preliminary decisions have now been made," wrote Neil Scheer. "I would be prepared to discuss these decisions, as well as the evidence amassed to date, with an attorney authorized to represent your interest." The government stated intentions to pursue its case against Arthur Rudolph, showing that Mr. Rudolph enforced the slave labor system at Middlebau, Middlework, and aided in the transmission of sabotage reports to the SS. Arthur Rudolph had two choices, the Justice Department said. He could hire a lawyer and prepare to stand trial, or, alternatively, he could renounce his U.S. citizenship and leave the country at once. 38 years after coming to America as part of Operation Paperclip, Arthur Rudolph left the United States on March 27, 1984. Neil Scheer met Arthur Rudolph at the San Francisco International Airport and made sure he got on the airplane. It was another 7 months before the Justice Department made public that Arthur Rudolph had renounced his citizenship so as to avoid facing a war crimes trial. When asked to comment, Eli Rosenbaum said that Arthur Rudolph had contributed to the death of thousands of slave laborers. But Rosenbaum also said that it was Rudolph's almost unbelievable callousness and disregard for human life that surprised him most. The story became front-page news around the world. Some individuals affiliated with NASA and other rocket-related government programs remained staunch supporters of Arthur Rudolph, calling the Justice Department's actions against him a witch hunt. One of Rudolph's leading proponents, Hugh McInnish, an engineer with the U.S. Army Strategic Defense Command, helped promote the idea that Rudolph, Dornberger, and Von Braun had all confronted members of the SS during the war and had tried to get better working conditions for the slave laborers. Their defendants' assertions must be regarded with the greatest skepticism, especially as there is not a single document to back them up, says Michael J. Neufeld. There is little doubt in my mind that Rudolph was deeply implicated. The Rudolph exposé triggered keen interest in how it was that Arthur Rudolph came to America in the first place. This was a turning point in Operation Paperclip's secret history. There is a broad misconception in America that there exists some kind of automatic declassification system that requires the government to reveal its secret programs after 30 or 50 years. In reality, the most damaging programs often remain classified for as long as they can be kept secret. The Freedom of Information Act, signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson, allows for the full or partial disclosure of some documents, but a request must be initiated by an individual or a group and is by no means a guarantee that information will be obtained. After the Arthur Rudolph story broke, journalist Linda Hunt began reporting on Operation Paperclip for CNN and the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. She filed FOIA requests with the different military organizations and intelligence agencies involved and received varied responses. "I obtained 6,000 Edgewood Arsenal documents in 1987, but it took more than a year, two attorneys, and a threatened lawsuit to get the records released, says Hunt. When she arrived at the Washington National Record Center in the late 1980s to inspect the documents, she was told that Edgewood's own historian had checked out 7 of the boxes and that another 12 were missing. The Army later agreed to look for the missing records and sent her a bill for $239,680 in so-called search fees, the equivalent of $500,000 in 2013. Eventually, Linda Hunt was granted access to the documents, and in the early 1990s, she published a book that unveiled many of Operation Paperclip's seemingly impenetrable secrets. It was now no longer possible for the government to uphold the myth that Paperclip was a program peopled solely by benign German scientists, nominal Nazis, and moral men. As if pushing back against the Office of Special Investigations, just a few months after Arthur Rudolph was expelled from the United States, the Texas Senate passed a resolution declaring that June 15th was Dr. Hubertus Strughold Day. Then Ohio State University's Medical College unveiled a portrait of Strughold on its mural of medical heroes. But the attempts by one organization to perpetrate a false myth can serve as a great motivator for another organization. And to this end, the World Jewish Congress discovered and released information on Dr. Strughold that Army intelligence had managed to keep classified for nearly 50 years. The New York Times verified that Dr. Strughold had been listed as among those being sought on the 1945 Central Registry of War Criminals and Security Suspects, or CROCAS list. Strughold's portrait was removed from the Ohio State mural, where he appeared, ironically, alongside Hippocrates. Citizens who were offended by the Strughold Library at the Brooks Air Force Base asked the Air Force when Strughold's name was going to be removed from the U.S. government building. Library spokesman Larry Farlow told the Associated Press that there were no plans to remove the name from the Strughold Aeromedical Library. But growing pressure from the public forced the Air Force to reconsider its position. In 1995, General Ronald R. Fogelman, Chief of Staff of the Department of the Air Force, issued a terse statement stating that after reviewing Nazi-era documents, the evidence of Dr. Strughold's wartime activities is sufficient to cause concern about retaining his name in an honored place on the library. The sign was removed from the building's exterior brick walls, and the Strughold bronze portrait was taken down. The permanence of the honor had come to an end. Strughold died the following year at the age of 88. The Justice Department had been preparing a Nazi war criminal case against Strughold in his final years. What does last? The desire to seek the truth? Or in the words of Jean Michel, the ability to take a stand against the monstrous distortion of history when it gives birth to false, foul, and suspect myths? In 1998, Congress passed the Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act, which required various U.S. government agencies to identify and release federal records relating to Nazi war criminals that had been kept classified for decades. In accordance with the act, President Clinton established an interagency working group made up of federal agency representatives and members of the public to oversee the interpretation of over 8 million pages of U.S. government records and report its findings to Congress. The documentation revealed a vast web of profitable relationships between hundreds of Nazi war criminals and U.S. military and intelligence agencies. In 2005, in a final report to Congress, U.S. Intelligence and the Nazis, the Interagency Working Group determined that the notion that they, the U.S. military and the CIA, employed only a few bad apples, will not stand up to the new documentation. In hindsight, wrote the interagency working group, the government's use of Nazis was a very bad idea, and there was no compelling reason to begin the post-war era with the assistance of some of those associated with the worst crimes of the war. And yet history now shows us that that is exactly what the American government did, and continued to do throughout the Cold War. In the decades since Operation Paperclip ended, new facts continue to come to light. In 2008, previously unreported information about Otto Ambrose emerged, serving as a reminder that the story of what lies hidden behind America's Nazi scientist program is not complete. A group of medical doctors and researchers in England, working on behalf of an organization called the Thalidomide Trust, believe they have tied the wartime work of I.G. Farben and Otto Ambrose to the thalidomide tragedy of the late 1950s and early 1960s. After Ambrose was released from Landsberg prison, he worked as an economic consultant to German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer and to the industrial magnate Friedrich Flick, the richest person in Germany during the Cold War. Like Ambrose, Flick had been tried and convicted at Nuremberg and then released early by John J. McCloy. In the late 1950s, Ambrose was also elected chairman of the advisory committee for a German company called Chemie Grünenthal. Grünenthal was about to market a new tranquilizer that promised pregnant women relief from morning sickness. The drug, called thalidomide, was going to be sold under the brand name Contergan. Otto Ambrose served on the board of directors of Grünenthal. In the late 1950s, very few people knew that Grünenthal was a safe haven for many Nazis, including Dr. Ernst Günther Schenck, the inspector of nutrition for the SS, and Dr. Heinz Baumkotter, an SS captain, Hauptsturmführer, and the chief concentration camp doctor at Mauthausen, Natzweiler Strutthof, and Sachsenhausen concentration camps. 10 months before Grünenthal's public release of thalidomide, the wife of a Grünenthal employee, who took the drug to combat morning sickness, gave birth to a baby without ears. No one linked the birth defect to the drug, and thalidomide was released by the company. After several months on the market in 1959, Grünenthal received its first reports that thalidomide caused polyneuropathy or nerve damage in the hands and feet of elderly people who took the drug. The drug's over-the-counter status was changed, so it now required a prescription. Still, thalidomide was marketed aggressively in 46 countries with a label that stated it could be given with complete safety to pregnant women and nursing mothers, without any adverse effect on mother and child. Instead, the drug resulted in more than 10,000 mothers giving birth to babies with terrible deformities, creating the most horrific pharmaceutical disaster in the history of modern medicine. Many of the children were born without ears, arms, or legs, and with reptilian, flipper-like appendages in place of healthy limbs. The origins of thalidomide were never accounted for. Grünenthal had always maintained that it lost its documents that showed where and when the first human trials were conducted on the drug. Then, in 2008, the Thalidomide Trust in England, headed by Dr. Martin Johnson, located a group of Nazi-era documents that produced a link between thalidomide and the drugs researched and developed by I.G. Farben chemists during the war. Dr. Johnson points out that Grünenthal's 1954 patents for thalidomide cryptically state that human trials had already been completed, but the company says it cannot offer that data because it was lost, ostensibly during the war. The patents suggest that thalidomide was probably one of a number of products developed at Duhern Fort, or Auschwitz-Monowitz, under the leadership of Otto Ambrose in the course of nerve gas research, Dr. Johnson says. The Thalidomide Trust also links paperclip scientist Richard Kuhn to the medical tragedy. Kuhn worked with a wide range of chemicals in his nerve gas research, and in his antidote research, we know he used Antergin, which we are fairly sure was a sister drug to Contergin, the brand name for thalidomide, Dr. Johnson explains. In 2005, Kuhn experienced a posthumous fall from grace when the Society of German Chemists, Gesellschaft Deutscher Chemiker, GDCH, announced it would no longer award its once prestigious Richard Kuhn Medal in his name. Nazi-era documents on Kuhn had been brought to the Society's attention, revealing that in the spring of 1943, Kuhn asked the Secretary General of the KWS, Kaiser Wilhelm Society, Ernst Telschau, to support his search for the brains of young and healthy men, presumably for nerve gas research. The Society of German Chemists maintains that the sources indicate that these brains were most likely taken from execution victims, and that, despite his scientific achievements, Richard Kuhn is not suitable to serve as a role model and eponym for an important award, mainly due to his research on poison gas, but also due to his conduct toward Jewish colleagues. It seems that the legacy of Hitler's chemists has yet to be fully unveiled. Because so many of these German scientists were seen as assets to the U.S. Army Chemical Corps' nerve agent programs and were thus wanted as participants in Operation Paperclip, secret deals were made, and the many documents pertaining to these arrangements were classified. President Clinton's interagency working group had access to 8 million pages of declassified documents, but millions more documents remain classified. In U.S. intelligence and the Nazis, the interagency working group's authors write that the truest reckoning with the official past can never be complete without the full release of government records. Part of the problem lies in identifying where the records are physically located. For example, a 2012 FOIA request to the State Department asking for the release of all files related to Otto Ambrose was denied on the grounds that no such files exist. But it is a matter of record, owing to a May 1971 news article in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, that Otto Ambrose traveled to the United States twice with the State Department's assistance, despite his status as a convicted war criminal. In an interview with State Department official Fred Scott, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency learned Ambrose came to the United States in 1967 after the State Department recommended to the Justice Department a waiver on his eligibility, which was granted, and that in 1969, Ambrose received a second visa waiver and traveled to the United States again. In the spring of 1971, Ambrose was attempting to get a third visa waiver from the State Department when the Jewish Telegraphic Agency reported the story. According to Fred Scott, Ambrose's host for his May 1971 visit was listed as the Dow Chemical Company. After the story was published, Jewish groups held protests, and Ambrose allegedly canceled his trip. But none of this information is contained in Ambrose's declassified U.S. Army files, FBI files, or CIA files. Otto Ambrose was a convicted Nazi war criminal. In accordance with the Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act, all files about him should have been released and declassified. But records that cannot be located cannot be declassified. Where are the Otto Ambrose records hidden? And what secrets might be guarded therein? Names and dates continue to come to light, and researchers, journalists, and historians continue to uncover new facts. fate and circumstance also inevitably play a part. In 2010, a cache of almost 300 documents was found in the attic of a house being renovated in the Polish town of Oświęcim near Auschwitz. The documents include information about several Nazi doctors and Farben chemists who worked at the death camp. The sensational value of this discovery is the fact that these original documents, bearing the names of the main murderers from Auschwitz, were found so many years after the war, says Adam Sira, a historian at the Auschwitz Museum. Otto Ambros lived until 1990, to the age of 92. After his death, the chemical conglomerate BASF, on whose board of directors he had served, lauded him as an expressive, entrepreneurial figure of great charisma. Is the old German proverb really true? Jedem das Seine. Does everyone get what he deserves? Still, as of 2013, the Space Medicine Association in America continues to bestow its prestigious Hubertus Strughold Award to a scientist or specialist for outstanding contribution to aviation medicine. It has done so every year since 1963. On December 1, 2012, the Wall Street Journal ran a page-one story about Dr. Strughold, presenting revelatory new information about his criminal activities during the war. German historian Professor Hans-Walter Schmull had been researching another subject when he came across evidence that showed that Dr. Strughold had allowed epileptic children to be experimented on inside the high-altitude chamber at Strughold's Aviation Medical Research Institute of the Reich Air Ministry in Berlin. Rabbits had been put to the test first and had died. Next, Reich medical researchers wanted to see what would happen to young children with epilepsy subjected to those same conditions. Strughold authorized the potentially lethal tests on the children. The head of the institute is responsible, says Schmuel. Using this expensive equipment, the head of an institute had to have been informed about the use. When the German Society for Air and Space Medicine learned about Schmuel's discovery, they eliminated their prestigious Strughold Award, which had been given annually in Germany since the mid-1970s. In America, the Wall Street Journal article renewed debate as to why the Space Medicine Association had not yet eliminated its Hubertus Strughold Award. Dr. Mark Campbell, a former president of the Space Medicine Association, insists the award will not go away. Campbell blames the internet for maligning what he sees as Dr. Strughold's good character. I was a member of a committee investigating Dr. Strughold to see if his name should be removed from the Space Medicine Association Strughold Award, says Campbell. I was amazed to find that the facts that were uncovered were so different from the claims being made on the internet. But most of Dr. Campbell's colleagues disagree. Why defend him? Asked Dr. Stephen Verono, a research medical officer at the FAA's Civil Aerospace Medical Institute in Oklahoma City, and a member of the Space Medicine Association. I can't find another example in the world of an institution honoring Dr. Strughold except my own association. The National Space Club Florida Committee, one of three committees of the National Space Club in Washington, D.C., gives out a similarly prestigious space-related award called the Dr. Kurt H. Debus Award. This annual award is named in honor of Operation Paperclip's Kurt Debus, who became the first director of the Kennedy Space Center. Kurt Debus is the scientist who, during the war, was an enthusiastic member of the SS, wore the SS uniform to work, and turned a colleague over to the Gestapo for making anti-Nazi remarks and failing to give Debus the Nazi salute. Under Operation Paperclip, Kurt Debus worked on missiles for the Army and for NASA for a total of 28 years, many of which he spent alongside Arthur Rudolph and Wernher von Braun. Kurt Debus retired in 1974. In 2013, after the Strughold Award debate resurfaced, I interviewed Steve Griffin, the National Space Club chairman, to determine why the organization continues to give out an award that is named after someone who was once an avowed and active Nazi. Simple as it is, Kurt Debus is an honored American, Griffin says. I read to Griffin information from Kurt Debus's OMGUS security report. It is a simple matter, Griffin told me. Kurt Debus was the first director of the Kennedy Space Center. Unlike the Strughold Award, which was created in 1963, when Strughold's foreign scientist case file was still classified, the Dr. Kurt H. Debus Award was first bestowed in 1990, after Debus's OMGUS security report had been declassified, and the revelation that he was an active member of Heinrich Himmler's SS had been revealed. It is not my purview to decide if we have an award or what it is called, Griffin says. But Griffin conceded that he has been on the board of the National Space Club since the Debus Award's inception, so technically it is and always has been within his purview. Like so many of those involved in Operation Paperclip decades ago, Griffin looks past Debus's former commitment to Nazi Party ideology. He only sees the scientist. What do you say when people ask you about Kurt Debus's Nazi past? I asked. Not a single person has asked me this question in 23 years, Griffin says. To report this book, I filed dozens of Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, requests, some of which were honored, many of which were denied, and most of which are still pending. I came across oblique references circa 1945 regarding a supposed list of Nazi doctors whom the Office of U.S. Chief of Counsel, U.S. Army, sought for involvement in mercy killings or medical murder crimes. FOIA requests for the list turned up nothing. Then, at the Harvard Medical Library, I found a collection of papers that once belonged to Colonel Robert J. Benford, the first commander of Operation Paperclip's Aviation Medicine Research Program at the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center in Heidelberg. Benford, with Dr. Strughold, oversaw the work of the 58 Nazi doctors at the center. Both Benford and Strughold worked under Colonel Harry Armstrong. In Benford's papers, I came across a file labeled List of Personnel Involved in Medical Research and Mercy Killings, but the access to the file was restricted until 2015. The Harvard Medical Library informed me that the Department of Defense had classified the list and that only the DOD had the authority to declassify it. Harvard filed a FOIA request on my behalf, and the mercy killings list was declassified and released to me. Included on this list, which had been in Colonel Benford's possession, were seven Nazi doctors hired under Operation Paperclip. Theodore Benzinger, Kurt Blume, Conrad Schaffer, Walter Schreiber, Hermann Becker-Friesing, Siegfried Ruf, and Oskar Schroeder. The fact became instantly clear. U.S. Army intelligence knew all along that these doctors were implicated in murder, yet chose to classify the list and hire the doctors for Operation Paperclip. Blume, Schaffer, Becker-Friesing, Ruf, and Schroeder were all tried at Nuremberg. Schreiber's public outing in 1951 and his subsequent banishment from America are now on record. But Dr. Theodore Benzinger seems to have slipped away from accountability. From his New York Times obituary in 1999, the world learned that Dr. Theodore Benzinger, 94, invented the ear thermometer, a nominal contribution to the medical world. As for the military world, Benzinger's research work for the Navy was destroyed or remains classified as of 2013. Wernher von Braun, Arthur Rudolph, Kurt Debus, and Hubertus Strughold led the American effort to get man to the moon. The question remains, despite a man's contribution to a nation or a people, how do we interpret a fundamental wrong? Is the American government at fault equally for fostering myths about its paperclip scientists? For encouraging them to whitewash their past so that their scientific acumen could be exploited for U.S. weapons-related work? When, for a nation, should the end justify the means? These are questions that can only be answered separately by individuals. But as facts emerge and history is clarified, the answers become more suitably informed. In addition to the ear thermometer, Theodore Benzinger left the world with the Planck-Benzinger equation, fine-tuning the second law of thermodynamics, which states that nothing lasts. Benzinger's lifelong scientific pursuit was studying entropy, the idea that chaos rules the world and, like ice melting in a warm room, order leads to disorder. I prefer Gerhard Machowski's take on what matters and what lasts. Machowski was the Jewish teenager fortuitously spared the gas chamber at Auschwitz because he was of use to IG Farben as a slave laborer at their Buna factory. I was interviewing Machowski one spring afternoon in 2012 when I asked him the question, "What matters? What lasts?" He chuckled and smiled. He pushed back the sleeve on his shirt and showed me his blue ink Auschwitz tattoo. "This lasts," he said, "but it is also a record of the truth." Principal characters. These brief character descriptions include information pertaining to the narrative of Operation Paperclip. Military titles refer to the highest rank achieved by individuals within the time frame of this story. The term doctor is used to identify medical doctors. William J. Almonds, post-war investigator with the U.S. War Crimes Division. He arrived on scene at the V-2 tunnel complex in Nordhausen shortly after it was liberated, found the telephone list that implicated George Ricke and Arthur Rudolph in slave labor, and served on the prosecution staff during the Dora Nordhausen war crimes trial. Dr. Leopold Alexander, Boston psychiatrist and neurologist sent to post-war Germany to investigate medical crimes. He later served as expert consultant during the Nuremberg Doctors' Trial and co-authored the Nuremberg Code. Otto Ambrose, IG Farben chemist, co-discoverer of sarin gas and Buna synthetic rubber. He was awarded 1 million Reichsmarks by Hitler as a scientific achievement award. Served the Reich as chief of the C Committee for Chemical Warfare. Manager of IG Farben's slave labor factory at Auschwitz, and manager of the Duhernfort poison gas facility. He was tried and convicted at Nuremberg, and after an early release, he worked for the U.S. Chemical Corporation, W.R. Grace, the U.S. Department of Energy, and other European government and private sector business concerns. Major General Dr. Harry G. Armstrong set up the post-war U.S. Army Air Force's Aero Medical Center in Heidelberg, employing 58 Nazi doctors, 34 of whom followed him to the U.S. Air Force School of Aviation Medicine in Texas, where he served as commandant. He was the second Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force. Colonel Burton Andrus, U.S. Army Commandant at Central Continental Prisoner of War Enclosure No. 32, codenamed Ashcan, the interrogation facility where the major Nazi war criminals were interred after the war. Later, as governor of the Nuremberg prison, he oversaw the hangings of the convicted high command Nazis. Herbert Axter, Nazi lawyer, accountant, and chief of staff on V weapons under General Dornberger. Axter and his wife, Ilse, were among the few individuals in Operation Paperclip to be outed by the public as ardent Nazis. Forced to leave Army employ, he opened a law firm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Harold Batchelor, U.S. Army expert in weaponized bubonic plague and co-designer of the eight-ball aerosol chamber at Camp Dietrich. As a member of the Special Operations Division, he and Frank Olson conducted covert field tests across America using a pathogen that simulated how bioweapons would disperse. Consulted with Dr. Bloma in Heidelberg after the Nuremberg doctor's trial. Warner Baumbach, wartime general of the bombers for the Luftwaffe, chosen by Albert Speer and Heinrich Himmler to pilot each man's escape from Germany. Originally part of Operation Paperclip, he instead went to South America, where he died in a plane crash. Dr. Hermann Becker-Freising, Nazi aviation physiologist under Dr. Strughold, who oversaw medical murder experiments on prisoners at the Dachau concentration camp. He was tried at Nuremberg, convicted, and sentenced to 20 years. Granted clemency, he was released in 1952. Dr. Wilhelm Beigelbuch, Nazi aviation physiologist who oversaw saltwater experiments at Dachau. He removed a piece of prisoner Karl Hüllenreiner's liver without anesthesia, one of the many crimes for which he was tried and convicted at Nuremberg. Sentenced to 15 years, Beigelbuch was granted clemency in 1951 and returned to work at a German hospital. Colonel Peter Beasley, officer with the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey sent to post-war Germany to locate engineers with knowledge about how underground weapons facilities were engineered. Recruited George Rickey for Operation Paperclip. Colonel Dr. Robert J. Benford, commanding officer at the U.S. Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center, he oversaw the research efforts of 58 Nazi doctors working in Heidelberg. Dr. Theodore Benzinger, wartime department chief of the experimental station of the Air Force Research Center in Raeklin, and chief of medical work in the research department of the technical division of the Reich Air Ministry. An ardent Nazi and member of the SA, Stormtroopers, with rank of medical sergeant major, he was hired to work at the U.S. Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center in Heidelberg, then arrested, imprisoned at Nuremberg, listed as a defendant in the doctor's trial, and mysteriously released. Under Operation Paperclip, he worked for the Naval Medical Research Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Kurt Bloma, Deputy Surgeon General of the Reich, Deputy Chief of Reich's Physicians League, and member of the Reich Research Council. He served as chief of the Reich's bioweapons facilities in Nesselstedt, Poland, and in Garaburg, Germany. An old fighter Nazi party member, he wore the Golden Party badge and was a lieutenant general in the SA, Stormtroopers. The JOA tried but failed to bring him to America. He worked for the U.S. Army at Camp King in Oberursel, Germany. William J. Cromarty, U.S. Army bacteriological warfare expert and officer with Operation Alsace. Kurt Debus, V Weapons flight test director and member of the SS, he turned a colleague over to the Gestapo for making anti-Nazi remarks. Under Operation Paperclip, he served as part of the Von Braun rocket team at Fort Bliss, Texas, and became the first director of NASA's John F. Kennedy Space Center in Florida. John Dalabaugh, U.S. Army officer with military intelligence who interrogated many of the Nazi Party high command interned at Ashcan, including Hermann Göring and Albert Speer. He was trained by General William Donovan in the art of interrogation. Major General William J. Donovan, founding director of the Office of Strategic Services, the forerunner to the CIA. After the German surrender, Donovan kept an office at Camp King in Oberursel, Germany, where he oversaw Nazis writing reports for the U.S. Army. Major General Walter Dornberger, wartime German general in charge of V-weapons development and the technical staff officer in the Nordhausen slave labor tunnels. He was arrested by the British for war crimes, interned in England, and later released into U.S. custody. Under Operation Paperclip, he worked for the U.S. Air Force and then Bell Aircraft Corporation. Until the late 1950s, he acted as a missile and space-based weapons consultant to the Joint Chiefs, carrying a top-secret clearance and visiting the Pentagon frequently. Captain R. E. F. Edelsten, British officer assigned to the Joint British-U.S. Interrogation Center at Castle Kranzberg, codenamed Dustbin. Donald W. Falconer, U.S. biological weapons explosives expert, who consulted with Dr. Bloma shortly after Bloma's acquittal at Nuremberg, colleague of Frank Olson at Camp Dietrich. Carl Otto Fleischer, allegedly the V-weapons business manager in Nordhausen, he played an important role in revealing to Major Staver the whereabouts of a key document stash after the German surrender. Under Operation Paperclip, he worked at Fort Bliss, Texas, until it was learned he was not a scientist, but worked in food services for the Reich's missile program. Dr. Karl Gebhardt, Himmler's personal physician and chief surgeon of the staff of the Reich Physician SS and Police. He was in charge of sulfa experiments at Ravensbrück, administered by Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber. He was convicted at the doctor's trial at Nuremberg, sentenced to death, and hung in the courtyard at Landsberg Prison. Lieutenant General Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's senior intelligence officer on the Eastern Front, he was hired by the U.S. Army to run the Gehlen Organization, a group that gathered intelligence on Soviet bloc spies at Camp King. The organization was taken over by the CIA in 1945, the majority of details kept classified until 2001. Hermann Göring, Reichsmarshal, Commander-in-Chief of the Luftwaffe, and the long-serving designated successor to Hitler. As head of the Reich Research Council, he was in charge of the coordination of all German research and streamlined Nazi science to weapons-related programs, making him the dictator of science. Sidney Gottlieb, director of the CIA's technical support staff, he oversaw the MK-Ultra program and, with his deputy Robert Lashbrook, covertly drugged bacteriologist Fred Olson with LSD during an agency weekend retreat. Samuel Goudsmit, American particle physicist and wartime scientific director of Operation Alsace. Born in Holland, Goudsmit spoke Dutch and German. He discovered documents in Nazi scientist Dr. Eugen Hagen's Strasbourg apartment that revealed Reich doctors were conducting deadly human experiments on concentration camp prisoners. John C. Green, executive secretary for the Office of Publication Board, a division of the Commerce Department. He was instrumental in getting Secretary of Commerce Henry Wallace to lobby President Truman to endorse Operation Paperclip. L. Wilson Green, technical director of the Chemical and Radiological Laboratories at Edgewood. His secret monograph entitled Psychochemical Warfare, A New Concept of War, was the genesis for the CIA's MK Ultra program. Colleagues with Paperclip, Fritz Hoffmann. Dr. Carl Gross, biological weapons researcher with the Hygiene Institute of the Waffen-SS. He was assigned by Himmler to work with Dr. Blomme at Posen.